And articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
A legacy set in silver. As Vogt Silversmiths closes in on 50 years of business, its founders reflect on traditions of family, silver, and the ranching lifestyle. By Lindsay Weltrell. There are certain professions that are passions, a part of your blood as much as your DNA. These are the livelihoods that get passed down from one generation to the next. Take ranching, the love of wide open spaces and making a living off the land has defined many families throughout history. The same can be said for work as a silversmith. One company, Vogt Silversmiths, embraces both. Founded in 1970 by Norm Vogt and his son Chet, Vogt Silversmiths is a Western buckle and accessories brand that values tradition and a job well done. This year, it celebrates 50 years in business. Before starting Vogt Silversmiths, Norm Vogt was a California rancher who had served in World War II as a Navy pilot. When he returned home to the San Joaquin Valley, it was to work his ranch and raise his family. Then, after a vacation to Mexico in the late 1960s, where silversmithing was a pillar of its culture, Norm found inspiration. Seeing the beautiful work and craftsmanship that fathers had been passing down to their sons for generations motivated Norm to get involved and help keep the craft alive for future generations. Once Norm found Vogt Silversmiths, there was no doubt it would become a family business. The company began as a bit-and-spur wholesaler when Chet was in his mid-20s, but the company quickly incorporated leatherwork, silver saddle accessories, and jewelry. Chet ran the office and handled the design work, while Norm hit the road, selling the brand's wares to Western stores around the country. Chet's brother Les took over the bit and spur business in the mid-1990s, and Chet focused on continuing to innovate with the company's products and growing Vogt Silversmiths as a belt buckle and accessories brand. Now, keeping the family traditions of ranching and silversmithing alive has become a mission of the Vogt family. Their products reflect the longevity of those multi-generational values, which their customers tend to share. It's a matter of what fits an individual's taste level, Chet says. If you want a handcrafted piece and unconditional lifetime guarantees, then you go to something like our product. We have people who have products they've worn for 20 to 30 years that are still very useful to them, or they pass on to the next generation. Our product is an enduring product, as opposed to something that is worn for a little while and replaced. Vogt uses only solid sterling silver and karat gold in its products, and follows time-honored techniques for filing, finish work, and soldering of the silver. In keeping with Norm's mission to preserve the craftsmanship of authentic old-world silver work, Vogt Silversmiths employs local craftsmen at their production facilities in Mexico. That's where the spirit of silversmithing lives, Chet says, adding that many of the brand's artisans are third-generation silversmiths. The level of talent these smiths employ is world-class. Over the company's past 50 years in business, what hasn't changed is the craftsmanship that marks the brand and the art of silverwork, Chet says. Vogt craftsmen still use tools and traditions that have been alive for hundreds of years, making everything by hand. However, Chet says the company intends to stay ahead of the game when it comes to design and engraving styles. Vogt's philosophy is, if you are not improving, someone else is, he says. Vogt has advanced its engraving styles to offer more detail and brighter cuts, and is constantly refreshing its selection of designs, while still maintaining the tradition, artistry, and Western values the company was founded on. For a family business to survive for 50 years is unusual, and it's meaningful, Chet says. How do you then perpetuate that business to continue? Because the business world is constantly changing. If you continue to do things exactly the same way all of the time, you will eventually put yourself out of business. Despite major accomplishments, such as making buckles for several presidents, Vogt has moved through the years with a steadfast approach. It's an evolution where you have a lot of small victories as you go, rather than a big change at any one point, Chet says. What makes us different is that we are a handcrafted business. All of the things are done by hand, so we have to constantly look at what we can do that cannot be done mechanically, done with a machine. So that's a big difference. When you are in the handcrafting business, you have to stay unique to your work. These days, many of Vogt's products, which consist of intricate and contemporary jewelry, custom belt buckle creations, and other accessories, are sold through fine retailers in the company's online platform. Keeping those styles fresh is something customers can expect to continue in the future. We're constantly upgrading our designs, Chet says. More color in the product, more use of stones, turquoise, onyx, semi-precious stones, that would be one thing the people could look forward to. Today, there are new generations involved in the family business, and as it was with Norm, ranching remains at the heart of the company. Chet and his wife Angela regularly work their cattle atop Angela's prized herd of horses, and a focus on service to the ranching industry is important to Chet, who has served on various boards and committees related to agriculture and conservation. This dedication feeds back naturally into the richness of the Vogt brand. There's an interesting connection between being from the land to interpretation of the product, Chet says. I have a different perspective on design and style because we live in the country and we live the life. It just gives a different perspective as to who we are, continuity of the product, continuity of the design, and that's allowed us to carry through 50 years. As the story of Vogt Silversmiths continues to unfold, it's clear that some things will always stay the same. Family, horses, cowboys, and of course, silver. The story of silversmithing in Mexico is a tumultuous one. Metallurgy, or metal working, began in Mesoamerican culture around 800 AD, but it was the mining for silver and gold that took center stage in the 1500s during the Spanish conquest. In the years that followed, the art of silversmithing in Mexico went through periods of both decline and resurgence, particularly spanning from its War of Independence in the 1800s through the 20th century. Legislation that made the West. Presidents can plan, but Congress acts. These are some of the most influential pieces of legislation affecting the West, for good or ill. Indian Removal Act, 1830. President Andrew Jackson. By 1840, the act that empowered the federal government to force Native Americans from tribal lands had moved tens of thousands from homes in the Southwest. The wholesale relocation, often by foot, to Indian territory in the West resulted in the Trail of Tears tragedy, which covered 5,043 miles across 9 states and claimed thousands of lives. The Homestead Act, 1862, President Abraham Lincoln. Congress encouraged mass settlement of the frontier by allowing any American, including free slaves, to put in a claim for up to 160 free acres of federal land. Millions moved west. Not coincidentally, the act became effective the same day the Emancipation Proclamation was issued, making January 1, 1863, perhaps the most consequential legislative date in U.S. history. The Pacific Railway Act, 1862, President Abraham Lincoln. Providing federal support for the first transcontinental railroad revolutionized Western life. Furthermore, it ensured California and potentially Oregon would not spin off into a separate, independent country, as they were tempted to do when the South seceded, says historian H.W. Brands. With the railroad, the California journey from points east that might have taken 6 months would take less than 6 days. The New Lands Reclamation Act, 1902, President Theodore Roosevelt. This law, authorizing the federal government to commission water diversion, retention, and transmission projects, transformed the West's vast arid tracts. These big irrigation projects and eventually hydroelectric projects that were necessary to make the desert bloom, as was the language of the time, they required federal money and federal ability, Brands says. The Antiquities Act, 1906, President Theodore Roosevelt. Initially passed to prohibit looting and desecration of Native American lands, the act gave the president authority to establish national monuments on lands of historic or scientific interest. Under it, Roosevelt established Devil's Tower in Wyoming as the first national monument, later adding Grand Canyon National Monument, now Grand Canyon National Park, and New Mexico's Gila Cliff dwellings. Bear Ears in Utah and Muir Woods in California are among the more than 150 national monuments created under the act. The National Interstate and Defense Highway Act of 1956, President Dwight Eisenhower. Eisenhower's call for a modern interstate highway system in his 1956 State of the Union address led to the largest public works program in U.S. history. His 46,876 miles of road, 55,512 bridges, and 14,756 interchanges transformed the nation, particularly in the West, where travel times between great distances was dramatically reduced by the expanded infrastructure. The Wilderness Act, 1964, President Lyndon Baines Johnson. The landmark legislation now protects 111 million acres of wilderness across the country, prohibiting roads, vehicles, and permanent buildings in some of America and the West's most iconic and pristine wildlands and landscapes. Some of the earliest areas of conservation include Minnesota's Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness, Wyoming's Bridger Wilderness, Montana's Bob Marshall Wilderness, and California's Ansel Adams Wilderness. Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, 1980, President Jimmy Carter. Regarded as the most sweeping Wilderness Protection Act ever approved by Congress, the bill created 79.54 million acres of refuge land in Alaska, paving the way for numerous national parks, national forests, national wildlife refuges, and national preserves. Here are some interesting articles from the October issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. Editor's note. Close to Home by Hunter Hawk. How many times have you heard or seen the phrase, stay home, this year? Too many to count, I'd imagine. Although troubling developments have caused all of us to alter our way of life for the time being, there have also emerged unexpected quiet blessings. We've been reminded anew of the importance of family and community. We've been reminded, too, of our fundamental goodness and grace, resilience and resourcefulness in the face of historic challenges. At CNI, we've had to rethink our tried and true way of doing things and come up with new approaches to respond to these singular circumstances. Where we were once free to visit any location, dispatch riders hither and yon, gather together in groups and get up close and personal with stars for everything from cookouts to cover shoots, these times have refocused us closer to home. The edition you hold is a prime example, and nothing more so than our special fashion feature. Over nearly three decades, we've strived to beautifully marry trends with time-honored traditions for looks that create fresh classics, and we've staged shootouts in locations as varied as the streets of the Fort Worth Stockyards and the fields of a nature preserve. For this issue's special fall fashion feature, we brought the shoot home to our literal backyard. With the midsummer sun forecast to bake the day into the low 100s, a skeleton crew of editors, models, and photographers arrived, masks and thermometers ready, for a very early a.m. call at the CNI Publishers Ranch in Weatherford, Texas. With acres and acres at our disposal, we worked from practically dawn to dusk to capture breathtaking outfits and accessories against the natural backdrop of the property. Despite the heat and the added difficulty of physical distancing, we got it done. It wasn't easy, but the results and the proof we could harness the can-do spirit of the American West right here at home made it well worth the effort. Speaking of spirits, this issue spotlights some of the greatest and tastiest tipples in the West. Just in time for your closer-to-home holidays, we present recommendations for whiskeys, tequilas, gins, beers, wines, and more, along with drink recipes that would blow the collective minds of the Old West's saloon barkeeps and patrons. So lift a glass to keeping close to home. Here in the West, we know how to preserve through tough times. We might need a little liquid fortitude once in a while. I know I've gotten through many an evening nursing on a certain ranch water created by a longtime friend of mine. Because you're family, I'll share the recipe with you. Search Sister Carrie's Ranch Water at cowboysandindians.com. I invite you to slake your thirst and feast your eyes. I'm thinking of you and the day we can all meet again as I sip. The Art Gallery. Grant Redden. At almost 8,000 feet in the foothills of the Juanita Mountains in southwest Wyoming, Grant Redden is at the easel in his 800-square-foot studio above the garage. Out the window, he can see aspen trees, a chicken coop, his garden, and a greenhouse. I used to be able to see the forest just south of us in Utah, about 4 or 5 miles away. But the aspens block my view in summer now, he says. It's still pretty, though. Redden makes his home on 120 acres of land that was part of his family's summer range. He might have grown up to take over their big sheep and cow outfit, but he got a degree in economics and began working as a real estate appraiser as something to fall back on while he tried to figure out how to be an artist full-time. I always wanted to be an artist, but I didn't always believe it was possible, he says. It just kept bugging me. If I wasn't working at it, I was thinking about it. He eventually saw a path forward, thanks in large part to painter Jim Norton. Jim Norton had just become a cowboy artist, Redden recalls. I called him and said, "Hey, I want to be an artist." He kind of chuckled and said, "Bring some of your stuff down and we'll take a look." So I took some stuff, mostly watercolors. He sat on a chair and just looked at it all without saying anything. It seemed like forever, but it was probably only about 10 minutes. Then he said, "Well, they're better than I thought they'd be. This is what you need to do if you want to be an artist. Start painting outdoors." He turned me on to some deceased artists to learn from and said I should take some workshops. The guidance was key, and Redden's art progressed to the point that in 1997 he let his real estate appraiser certification expire and devoted himself to painting. At another career juncture, it was Norton, once again, who pointed the way, encouraging Redden to submit work for membership consideration in the Cowboy Artists of America. "I was reluctant because I never thought I was good enough," Redden said. "But Jim encouraged me and said, 'Give me some images I can show the guys.'" On their spring trail ride, the CAs took a look at images of artwork by prospective new members and take a vote whether they want to see originals by the artist. If 3/4 vote in your favor, they contact you and invite you to bring your originals to the fall meeting before the CA show. "I brought 5 original works to the 2012 fall meeting, and they voted me in." At the time of our interview, Redden's at work on an as-yet-untitled piece for November's Cowboy Artists of America exhibition and sale. It's 36 by 36 and has a cowboy on a horse with some Navajo ponies behind him, a conglomeration of some photo references I've taken over the years. I can tell you exactly what it is now, but in a month it might be totally different. Eventually titled Navajo Ponies and completed in time for the publication of this article, the painting is shown on page 59. He'll stay busy painting for the CA show and working on commissions, and he'll be spending quality time with his wife. When he takes a break from the easel, they just might head outside. There's a little pond on the property, and we go down and paddle around in a canoe looking for frogs. Dana Joseph. Mark Rorick. Apologizing that he can't find words to describe what he puts in paint, Mark Rorick suggests going to his website and reading an interview he gave in the dark, which he thinks is bound to be closer to capturing the spirit of his work than the interview he's about to give me right now in daylight, on the phone, from his studio in Grand Junction, Colorado. "It's feelings," he says. "It's inexplicable. Finding words for it? Why bother when you can look at the paintings and feel?" Point taken. This is art that is meant not to just be hung and admired, but also to be felt. As usual, Rorig's been busy painting, happily holed up. "I just come in here and hibernate," he says. "Sometimes for me, it's almost more home than home. I'm a recluse anyway." It's not that he's alone. "I have 2 daughters," he says. "One works with the elderly. The other is an artist in Poinoya, Colorado, in the mountains." Raven Rorig, who paints a lot of women and birds, and does very well. "And I have 5 grandkids under 10 that I'm close to. I bring the little ones out here and let them paint. They love it." We talked to Rorig about the mystery of art and the heart and soul he puts into it. You were raised in Grand Junction. What made you drive with your paintings to a gallery in Taos, New Mexico when you were only 19? I had a mentor, instructor, who I had worked with since I was about 12, who liked going to Taos and taking in the art community there. She was an award-winning art teacher, and she liked taking classes from artists in Taos. She took photos of my pieces and took them with her when she went there for a seminar. At a certain point, I went to Taos with some of my paintings. I really admired Frank Howell's portraits of Native Americans and stopped at a gallery where I saw some of his paintings in the window. I nervously walked in and talked to the director, and then Frank Howell himself emerged from the back. That was a very mystical happening and the beginning of my professional career. Do you still describe your work as a mystical realism? It's the go-to term I use because there's realism and emotional mind flow to it, too. Some of the stuff is just dreamed up. What are you working on right now? I just finished a piece called Hawk, a very noble face with lots of neat color. You can feel there's life and a sense of freedom. There's an element of an emotion that is solemn yet noble. That nobility seems to show up in most of my work. Are your Native American portraits based on models, or do their likenesses come to you in some other way? It happens so fast when an idea comes to me. I've been drawing so many years, it comes very automatically. In the early years, in my early teens, I probably looked at books with Indians in them and just formulated my own view. Today, it just shows up. How about music to paint by? In the studio, I like favorite music from the 60s, maybe up to the early 80s. I like rock and roll, easy rock, Neil Young, that kind of thing, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, some of the Woodstock people. Some famous folks own your paintings. Any names you want to drop? Well, the truth of all that is I'm not absolutely sure. Mariah Carey's home in Aspen had a big painting of mine, but these are rumors. I heard a rumor that Eric Clapton might have purchased something. Galleries don't disclose these things. They protect their collectors. David Coverdale from Whitesnake. I know he owns some of my stuff. I can tell you I've sold every painting I've ever painted, but it's best to be humble about these things. What do you mean by capturing the universe of love, and how do you go about doing that? Well, the work I do today is a very spiritual process. I'm not a sage or anything. I'm just a person who listens carefully inside. I've spent a lot of time by myself. I'm a person who believes in love. It happens as I'm flowing. It's a mystery. It's not calculated. It happens. It happens to the colors, the shapes, the people's faces. I use the Indian as a vehicle of love, to express love. It's like a symbol, an embodiment. In addition to love, what do you hope people will experience when looking at your paintings? Each person gathers their own feelings. What I hope to convey to people is an art expression of what's going through my heart and soul. I want them to enjoy the art, feel an uplifting spirit, feel a rising of spirit. I want to give a painting a freedom where people can look at it and let it be a window. Dana Joseph. Duke Beardsley. The image of a lone cowboy working cattle in the wide open spaces of the West is a soothing, unchanging, timeless symbol of America. But that's not reality on the range, and it certainly isn't the reality in Duke Beardsley's Denver studio. The cowboy icon is one of the most recognized in the world. You can whip out a picture of a cowboy anywhere, and people will know what it is, Beardsley says. But today's vibrant, forward-minded, sustainable ranching culture is embracing a rapidly changing West. Beardsley's bold take on the changing cowboy archetype will be on view in his first museum show with sculptor Greg Woodard, beginning in late October at the Booth Western Art Museum in Cartersville, Georgia. The exhibition, Indians and Cowboys, redefined by Duke and Woodard, covers sacred turf he knows firsthand and isn't afraid to challenge with a non-traditional approach. A sixth-generation Coloradoan, Beardsley grew up splitting his time in the 1980s between Denver and his family's 1,000-acre ranch on the plains of eastern Colorado. He spent his childhood learning to rope from cowboys and after drawing them. After graduating from Art Center College of Design in Pasadena, California, he brought his cowboy idols to large-scale canvases. As his career developed, so did his distinctive style. He calls it a mashup of contemporary design and traditional ranching of the American West, with visual references to pop art, abstract expressionism, and traditional Western art of the early 20th century. Along the way, Beardsley happened on an unconventional, sometimes provocative perspective, isolating this treasured icon, taking it out of the traditional herd-bound context of the Western landscape was an unconscious thing, Beardsley says. What does it mean to take this much-beloved figure, extract it from its comfort zone, and force it into a color realm that is much more akin to Rauschenberg and Warhol than Remington and Russell? What kind of dialogue does it provide? What doors does it open or shut? I'm comfortable without knowing the answers, but I like allowing those questions. Best known for combining images of big working cowboys and rows of silhouetted riders, the artist doesn't come to the canvas with his many preconceived notions. "The only thing I ask of the lineup riders is that they're straight," Beardsley says. "Sometimes they overlap the cowboy and have a contest to see who's on top. I love letting them sort it out. I've learned to get out of the way as quickly as possible." Their identities obscured, as is often the case with icons, his cowboys ride off the range and into the imagination. I pull his hat down, put his face in shadow, and viewers can have their own narrative, he says. Beardsley spends a lot of time on horseback, throwing a rope or getting down on the ground mugging calves or whatever needs doing. "The people in the paintings are real people, friends of mine," he says. "I was right there with these guys, out riding and roping and branding. I've ridden these horses. Some of them are mine. I rely on that physical experience as much as visual references from a camera." His process involves taking a lot of pictures, sometimes thousands, in a morning. At night, he sketches from those visual notes, and things start to gel, he says. "I like the gesture of that horse. I like that rider's upper body and this rider's lower body." He calls his works painted drawings, and drawings remain the heart of what he does. "Once I move to canvas, it takes over," Beardsley says. "I draw images at scale, freehand, in charcoal, on the canvas. Then I build layers of gray with acrylic paint I've thinned like watercolor. Sometimes pictures stay black and white. Sometimes they move to color. If it feels turquoise, it's turquoise. The image takes over." Beardsley keeps giving his imagination free rein and feels there's a lot of room to run. "I've thrown a lot at the cowboy icon, and it can take it," he says. "It's had no problem handling everything I challenged it to be." Kimberly Field. Real estate. Seven Lakes Ranch. Peek inside Greg Norman's sprawling property in the Colorado's White River Valley. by Emily Laskowski. I spent most of my adolescent times in the outback of Queensland, Australia, hunting, fishing, crabbing, exploring, riding horses and dehorning bulls, says Greg Norman, the Australian golfing legend, two-time major winner, and former world number one. So when I first saw the Meeker Valley and the White River, I fell in love with all the attributes it offered to my Australian soul. Seven Lakes Ranch, Norman's nearly 12,000-acre property in northwest Colorado, that boasts a 13,000-square-foot lodge with eight guest suites, is on the market. C and I asked Norman to share what he has loved most about this place, to which he responded, "Everything. Each day is a new adventure." Expanding on those adventures, Norman explained just what has made everything so special. Fly fishing, our 2+ miles of pure, never fed or stocked natural fisheries on the White River, over the 20+ years I've owned the ranch, has been a pleasure, especially as I've gotten to know the natural honey holes. Riding my horses, either on property or in the natural forest and wilderness, to take long daily hikes. Trying a new trail as often as we possibly could to take guests to certain parts of the ranch where the vistas are breathtaking for a picnic or sunset cocktails. Fishing up the lakes up at the lodge, where it'd be the summer or iced over in the dead of winter, to snowshoeing and snowmobiling in the flat tops. Sitting, listening quietly to the silence of the mountains, the wailing of the coyotes, or the bugling of elk that I think is the most beautiful sound in nature. Using the Sporting Clays Ranch that my wife so loves, to using my long-range rifle range that goes out to 1,500 yards, or using my pistol range. The serenity I get from running my John Deere 670D road maintainer, grading the nearly 90 miles of roads that make up the ranch each spring, to running my D6 bulldozer when need be. Or finally, just relaxing by the fire, watching sunsets that produce such vibrant colors and beauty that are impossible to capture in any photo. The activities are endless and so easily accessible. Over the years, it's been amazing to watch our family, friends, and guests embrace the mountains as they unleash their inner cowboy or cowgirl. Seven Lakes Ranch is listed by Brian Smith of Hall and Hall. Gone Lodging. The new hunting lodge in Oregon is already among the West's best getaways. By Chuck Thompson. Of the many inspiring attractions in central Oregon, the high desert paradise where Oregon city dwellers escape for solitude and mountain scenery, the one I'd choose for a small party or family gathering is the penthouse suite at Huntington Lodge, just outside of Bend. There are cinematic views of the Cascade Mountain skyline, with nine peaks soaring into unblemished skies, and west-facing rooms with large private terraces that take full advantage of the region's sage and sunshine vibe. Inside, the two-bedroom suite is just as event-ready. An open dining room, full chef's kitchen with marble counters, dark wood floors, and interior flourishes crafted by local artisans. Handcrafted Oregon-made furnishings draw on Japanese, Scandinavian, and West Coast traditions. The penthouse showcases the pinnacle attractions of the lodge, but each of the 104 guest rooms and suites features unique art, luxury furnishings, and commanding views of the Cascades or surrounding desert. Designed by hip Portland firm OMFGCO, the property's sleek style represents a departure from the classic Alpine feel. Heavy wood beams, overstuffed leather furniture, brocade pillows. typical of mountain lodges. Opened in 2019, Huntington Lodge is the crowning piece of the Pronghorn Resort, home to a pair of world-class golf courses that somehow remained the West's best-kept golf secret. The Nicholas Back Nine, carved from a flow of volcanic rock, may be the most delightful Jack has ever designed, with gambling holes and gorgeous scenery at every turn, raved Golf Digest of the resort's Jack Nicklaus public course. The private Tom Fazio-designed course features a mind-blowing eighth hole built on top of a lava tube. The Pronghorn Academy offers the kind of high-level club fitting and performance coaching found mostly at hotshot resorts in California, Arizona, Texas, and Florida. People don't think about the Pacific Northwest in terms of golf instruction, but I liken this place to Field of Dreams. Build it, and they will come, says Academy Director of Instruction Jeff Ritter, who relocated to Pronghorn from the Pebble Beach area in California, and also is Natural Director of Nike Junior Golf Camps. Build it, they did. Surrounded by a 1,000-year-old juniper forest preserve, the Pronghorn's side-by-side courses opened in the early 2000s. People have come, but not so many that there's ever the feeling of being overcrowded. For all the modernity, there's history on the resort grounds. Running through a corner of the property, the Huntington Wagon Trail was a 250-mile route used for hauling supplies south from the Dalles on the Columbia River to Fort Klamath, near present-day Klamath Falls. Developed by namesake John W. P. Huntington, a California gold seeker who became an Oregon state representative, then Abraham Lincoln's superintendent of Indian Affairs in Oregon, the trail was active until the late 1870s. Today, arrowheads, tree blazes, and wagon ruts can be seen along an easy 2-mile walk. Once guests arrive here in central Oregon, they rarely feel compelled to leave the property. 4 top-notch dining options, an expansive adults-only pool, electric bikes, and other attractions keep visitors happy on the resort grounds. When the urge to explore strikes, breweries along the Bend Ale Trail with Mount Bachelor Ski Resort are easy draws. For large parts of the year, you can ski in the morning, golf at Pronghorn in the afternoon, and finish the day with a Huntington cocktail. The sprig of burnt sage in the glass is a reminder you're in one of the West's most tasteful lodges. For more information about Huntington Lodge and Pronghorn Resort, visit pronghornresort.com. Rory Feek's Extraordinary Ordinary Life. The singer-songwriter gives CNI his personal take on his new RFD TV show about raising his daughter after his wife's death, working on his farm, and building his own Mayberry outside of Nashville, by Allison Bonaguro. When Rory Feek looks out the window of the home on his Tennessee farm, he sees two things that will forever bookend his story. On his left, the cross, memorializing where his late wife Joy is buried, and on his right, the special schoolhouse he built for their young daughter, Indiana, who has Down syndrome. This is the life Feek lives now, building his own version of Mayberry in Columbia, also known as Muletown for the mules that were trained for military service here during World War I. It's worlds away from Nashville and from the life he thought he'd be living with his wife and singing partner by his side. But Feek's not afraid to share the ups and downs. "Privately, I'm very public," he says, "and publicly, I'm very private." The story really began back when Feek and his wife met and married in 2002 and then quickly formed a country music duo, Joey plus Rory. They became a household name in 2008 and brought overalls back when they were on the talent reality show Can You Duet? They came in third and released their classically country toe-tapper, Cheater, Cheater. From there, the Feeks' private and personal lives were stacked top to bottom with nothing but joy. The duo was named the Academy of Country Music's Top New Vocal Duo in 2010. They released much-needed country music. Joey and her sister-in-law, Marcy Gary, opened Marcy Joe's Meal House and Bakery down the road from the Feeks family farm. Rory wrote hit after hit for other country artists. Joey found out she was pregnant with her first child. The Joey plus Rory show was a hit on RFD-TV, and all was well. Until it wasn't. Feek had been documenting the couple's rural life before his wife died of cancer at age 40 in 2016, when Indiana was just 2 years old, and he kept on telling their stories in his blog, The Life I Live. That blog has taken on a life of its own and inspired a TV series on RFD-TV, the flagship network for the Rural Media Group. It was, Feek says, a natural evolution. The show's about his family and regular small-town community. We live on a farm an hour south of Nashville and have a big barn which people travel to from all across the country, and a one-room schoolhouse where my little one and a dozen other kids from our community go. Both of my sisters and their families live here on the farm in houses on either side of ours. Along with an even larger cast of characters we're surrounded by, we all do life together. Press materials say that people with values and people who want peace and love in their lives will find Rory's new show to be a huge blessing. Rory himself seems to count it all as a blessing. I feel like God's given us a tremendous story, he says. In country music, some of the saddest stories are the greatest stories, and you can't have a great story without some great conflict and pain. And God's given us a life that's beautiful and hard, and the only thing better than writing a great story would be living one. There's a lot going on in the show, because there's a lot going on during a typical day on Feek's farm. After walking Indy to the schoolhouse, tending to the gardens and the animals, and working on his new TV series, he never really knows what the day might bring. Storylines organically follow what's happening in his life. One episode might revolve around opening a new location of the family restaurant, Marcy Joe's Mule Town, or the action in the garden. Currently he's growing lettuce, Brussels sprouts, carrots, potatoes, squash, zucchini, and tomatoes, to name a few. Or the latest additions to the barnyard. He recently bought some pigs, cows, and baby chicks. It's a long to-do list with one very obvious omission. There's no mention of songwriting. Feek admits that he hasn't written any songs in about 5 years. I moved to Nashville in 1995 with the hopes of learning how to tell great stories, he says. I wanted to learn to tell stories like my heroes, Gary Burr, Harlan Howard, and Skip Ewing. I'd like to think that I learned how to do it. Despite having written so many songs for Blake Shelton, Clay Walker, Randy Travis, Kenny Chesney, Terry Clark and Lori Morgan, Tracy Byrd, Colin Ray, and more, it sounds like Feek's hit-making days are behind him. For the indefinite future, anyway. It's not that there's no inspiration. It's that he's in a different season of his life. He brings up The Chain of Love, which he co-wrote and which became a hit for Clay Walker in 2000. The heartwarming tale of a random act of kindness by a guy named Joe. The song leaves Feek a little empty these days. Still, he's more determined than ever not to let The Chain of Love end with him. I realize that I don't want to write a great story about someone who's done something wonderful, he says. I want to live a great story. What if I could be that guy? What if I could be Joe in my own life? And I realized that was way more fulfilling. Still, he says, he'll always be a songwriter. There was a legendary songwriter when I moved to Nashville, and I remember sitting next to him in a Q&A one time. Someone asked him, "Do you consider yourself more of a lyricist or more of a musical songwriter?" He goes, "I consider myself more of a truck driver." And the point was that he's a truck driver writing songs. And that's what gave him such a common everyman voice. So I'm really a songwriter who's writing a blog and making television shows. I consider myself a songwriter because that's how I see life. It's how my pen works, he says. But I'm not writing songs. I'm storytelling in different ways. Two very silver linings have already come out of Feek's storytelling. The first is the Hardison Mills School, a one-room schoolhouse that he built for Indiana and other local children. He had the strength of the community behind him and beside him, as in a true Heartland barn raising. The plan was for Joey to homeschool Indy, Feek says, but that wasn't an option anymore. So this was a way to have a school at home for her. I'm a unique enough dreamer to say, what if we just built a school where it doesn't matter if you learn differently? Because we're all just God's people. The school is staffed with traditional teachers, plus real-life specialists like farmers, chefs, beekeepers, retirees with various skill sets, and more. The second is the Grammy Award Feek picked up about a year after Joey died. The couple's Hymns That Are Important to Us won the Grammy for Best Roots Gospel Album in 2017. They made the album while Joey was going through chemo and radiation. In his acceptance speech, Feek said that while they watched the 2016 Grammys together, his wife had told him, "If we get nominated, promise me you'll come. If we win, I'll know before you will."